Good morning. It's 7 a.m. and 45 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 65 and it will be mostly sunny. This Thursday, March 11th, 2021. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial free speech radio, WBAI, New York. Coming up next, a new day. A conversation with Dr. Zebulon Maletsky. Dr. Maletsky is an associate professor of Africana studies and historian of African American history, civil rights, and the Black Power movement. He also teaches urban history, mixed race and biracial identity, and hip hop studies. His publications include Separatist City, The Mandela Roxbury Movement and the Politics of Secession, Self-Determination, and Community Control, 1983 to 1986. His new book, Before Busing, Boston's Long Freedom Movement in the Cradle of Liberty, is being published by UNC Press later this year. Stay tuned for headlines. And this is your update on the COVID-19 pandemic. The House approved the final version of President Biden's $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief bill on Wednesday, handing the new president a significant legislative victory as he works to stabilize an economy still struggling to rebound from the depths of the COVID-19 pandemic. The bill has significant bipartisan approval in the country. This is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
We will give the American Rescue Plan a resounding and hopefully bipartisan vote to reflect the bipartisan support that it has in the country. On this vote, the yeas are 220, the nays are 211. The motion is adopted.
Also in New York, we now know that New York will lower its age threshold for COVID-19 vaccine eligibility beginning on Wednesday, allowing anyone older than 60 to be inoculated. This according to an announcement by Governor Andrew Cuomo on Tuesday. The state will also expand its eligibility requirement next week to open vaccination to a large number of public-facing workers, including government employees, nonprofit workers, and essential building services workers. Those people can begin to get vaccinated on March 17th. This is Governor Cuomo speaking at the press conference on Tuesday.
Our initial threshold was essential workers, nursing homes, 65 plus. We're going to drop the 65-year-old plus to 60-year-old plus, and that's going to start tomorrow. Second, all sites starting March 17th, next Wednesday, all sites, county sites, FQHC sites, mass vaccination sites, to simplify the situation, can vaccinate anyone who is eligible. With one exception, pharmacies still will only be doing 60 plus and teachers. Also on March 17th, next Wednesday, the public-facing public employees will also be eligible. Not-for-profit public-facing emergency employees and employees who are providing necessary services like the YWCA, they will also be available. Essential public workers will also be available. Public-facing building workers will also be available.
And among the workers eligible to get vaccinated next week are public workers, employees, self-service and child service caseworkers, government inspectors, sanitation workers, election workers, Department of Motor Vehicle employees, and county clerks. New York will join a handful of other U.S. states that allow vaccination for all people over 60. The majority have set their age eligibility requirement at 65 years old. And more news on New York, and this is quite a turning point, perhaps, for the future of young people in the city. A landmark lawsuit filed just on Tuesday could potentially affect all New York State public schools. It could force fundamental changes to how New York City's public school students are admitted into selective schools, and it marks the latest front in a growing political activist and now legal movement to confront inequality in the nation's largest school system. The legal challenge is brought by civil rights attorneys and student plaintiffs in state Supreme Court in Manhattan. It places much needed scrutiny a New York school system considered among the most racially and socioeconomically segregated in the United States. The students argue that the city's school system has replicated and worsened racial inequality by sorting children into different academic tracks as early as kindergarten, and has therefore denied many of its roughly 1 million students their right to a basic, sound education. Let's listen to Jesus and Farilatu, two of the student plaintiffs.
My name is Jesus. I am a senior currently. My story starts when I was in pre-K. That was the first time I entered the New York City public school system. I grew up in a Black and Latinx neighborhood. My first time going to elementary school was the first time I ever seen a white person. I grew up in a neighborhood where there were no white people. A school within a predominantly Black and brown neighborhood. No, with no white people, yet they were the ones teaching me. The first time I really seen racism within my entire experience was the first time I took an exam. You know, and standardized testing was always something that stood out to me because I always performed horrible on them. Just to later discover that those standardized tests were never made for me. If you look at the history of standardized testing, it is literally rooted in racism and rooted in eugenics. And not just standardized testing. Right, even within the curriculum, I never learned anything about my Mexican heritage. Heck, nah, they assimilated me. I hated being Mexican. I was ashamed of it. I wanted to be American. That's what it meant, right? And I always associated American with whiteness.
My name is Fadila Tu. I am a senior at Brooklyn Latin, and I'm here because I believe in creating the change that I want to see. The journey to anti-racist education cannot wait as long as we recognize the true fact that all students deserve to be valued. Similar to CJ, I attended a charter school in the South Bronx that was predominantly Black and Latinx and was the only Black student within my grade to get accepted into a specialized high school. Even prior to actually taking the test, though, along with my peers in my middle school, we didn't have much exposure to the resources that would prepare us for the test in the first place. So in what ways is that fair? Specifically as youth, especially on this call, the youth who are experiencing this educational system, right, directly, they're having these experiences. I'm having these experiences. CJ's having these experiences. Jesus, we don't stand out as like this unique group that is different from others. You know, there are so many different students that go through the same things, and this needs to end. Can you see me? All right, folks. We've had problems this morning. I have a new computer. My computer broke down last night. And I'm on a brand new computer, but clearly we've got problems. I was having a whole conversation with you all, telling you that there is going to be a big fight here in New York City, because this issue of the public schools has been one of the most polarizing issues in the history of the city and its public school system. And I was saying, thinking that y'all were listening to me, that the predominantly white middle class folks whose children go to these selective schools are going to start a riot in New York. Defendants of this suit include Governor Andrew M. Cuomo, Mayor Bill de Blasio, and the incoming school's chancellor, Maisha Porter. If the students are successful, the city could be compelled to restructure or even eliminate current admissions policies for hundreds of selective schools, including gifted and talented programs and academically selective middle and high schools. The suit could also accelerate pressure on Ms. Porter to articulate a New York City school integration plan. The outgoing chancellor, Richard A. Carranza, resigned from his post over disagreements with the mayor about how aggressively to pursue desegregation. Mark Rosenbaum, one of the lawyers suing the city and the state, said, quote, "This is the first case in the nation to seek a constitutional right to an anti-racist education." Mr. Rosenbaum, the director of public counsel opportunity under law, a Los Angeles-based pro bono law firm, is joined on the case by prominent civil rights lawyer Benjamin Crump, along with the law firm Sidley Austin and Integrate, Sidley Austin, and then another organization called Integrate New York City, and that's a youth-led integration program. This is Sarah Medina Camiscioli, founder and co-chair of Integrate New York City.
This lawsuit challenges a racial caste system in the New York State public education system and asserts the rights of students under the New York State Constitution to an education that identifies and dismantles racism. This lawsuit invites us to build a new future where youth guide us to build schools that heal, that liberate, and that educate our communities.
And we will have a conversation here at A New Day with the team behind the lawsuit next Wednesday, March 17th, so stay tuned. This could actually be turned into a novella. I'm excited about how this lawsuit is going to influence the politics of the city. The freaks are going to come out, I assure you. The charges against Breonna Taylor's former boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, stemming from last March's fatal Louisville Metro Police shooting of Ms. Taylor, are gone for good. Jefferson Circuit Court Judge Olu Stevens ruled Monday, March 8th, that the charges would be dismissed with prejudice, meaning he cannot be recharged for the shooting of a Louisville officer who was part of the police raid that killed Ms. Taylor, meaning Kenneth Walker cannot be recharged. Walker was arrested and charged with assault and attempted murder of a police officer after Walker shot Sergeant Jonathan Mattingly, and he shot Mattingly in the thigh as police burst into Taylor's apartment with a search warrant shortly before 12 a.m. last March. In a statement, attorney Steve Romines said Walker is relieved the case is closed. Romines said in the statement, "We believe the city used Kenneth as a pawn to cover up the events that took place on March 13, 2020, and further used him to cover up the deep-seated failures within the Louisville Metro Police Department. It does not go unnoticed that neither the city nor the LMPD has apologized for using Kenneth as scapegoat for an improper raid gone bad." This is Kenneth Walker's attorney, Steve Romines.
Under Kentucky law, you have to investigate self-defense claims in the Castle Doctrine before you even arrest and charge somebody. You are protected from even being arrested by law if you act in self-defense in your own home. Yet that didn't occur here. Kenny was arrested that night and jailed, prosecuted, indicted.
And Walker has maintained he did not know police were at the door that night and thought intruders were breaking in when he fired one shot from his legally owned handgun. Walker posted on Instagram last week about the motion to dismiss, saying, quote, "I'm blessed for sure, but there's a lot more to be done. We're going to get justice for Breonna Taylor," he wrote. And it's 7:20 and 45 degrees in Central Park. You're tuned to listener sponsor WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day.
How you get closer to love? How you eliminate all your sadness when you opening up? How you make excuses for billionaires you broke on a bus? I need niggas around me rolling up and smoking me up. Because my rainforest cries. Everybody dies a little. And I just wanna dance tonight. And I just wanna dance tonight. Ah, yeah. He my little baby Medusa, tipping the juice up. I go back and forth in an Uber, travel for 2 months. I'm the emptiest, hallelujah. Open my chest up, it's a rabbit inside my hat. Angel all dressed up, looking to bless up at the milk and the honey gates. I make money for money's sake, I've been writing 100 days. To the wretched out the earth and called it baby for none. And on my shoulder blades, a shattered wing to carry me home. I said, baby, come on. You know this flesh is only temporary, brittle as bone. Why don't you empty out your love for me, then chisel the stone? These are 10 black commandments, a property loan. Cause every blade of grass on earth we don't actually own. I am the I am, says Sam, am I? The universe bleeds infinity, you got one life. Yeah. How you get closer to love? How you eliminate all your sadness when you opening up? How you make excuses for billionaires you broke on a bus? I need niggas drugs around me, rolling up and smoking me up. Because when rainbows pass, everybody dies a little. And I just wanna dance tonight. I just wanna dance tonight. If you think you love me, then bury me when the sun up. Faded with the homie, he purling another blunt up. Talking to Muhammad like niggas don't really trust us. Dying on stolen land for a dollar like that ain't fucked up. It's fucked they money. I'ma say it every song into the revolution coming. All the feds start running. Goodwill hunting, this is brand new murder. Revolutionary suicide, then close the curtain. You ain't seen death, I can hear the blood on the moon. Put a flag upon it, all they do is consume. Only animal to ravage everything in its path. They turned a natural resource into a bundle of cash. Made the world anti-black, then divided the class. Not a rich showbread, really big figures, some cokeheads. These cokeheads, man, fuck a billionaire. Yeah. How you get closer to love? How you eliminate all your sadness when you open it up? How you make excuses for billionaires you broke on the bus? I need niggas around me rolling up and smoking me up. Because when rainbows grass, everybody dies in love. And I just wanna dance tonight. I just wanna dance tonight.
And that was Rainforest by No Name. Today we'll have a conversation with Dr. Zebulon Maletsky. Dr. Maletsky is an associate professor of Africana Studies and historian of African American Studies, Civil Rights, and Black Power. He also teaches urban history, mixed race and biracial identity, and hip-hop studies. His publications include Separatist City, the Mandela-Roxbury Movement, and The Politics of Secession, Self-Determination, and Community Control, 1983 to 1986. He's also the author of the forthcoming title, Before Busing, Boston's Long Freedom Movement in the Cradle of Liberty. And that book is due to be published with UNC Press later this year. Dr. Maletsky, welcome to A New Day.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my goodness, I'm so glad I can hear you. We've had problems with sound. I invited you to this show because I noticed on Facebook that you've been the recipient of a pretty exciting award, but we're going to talk about that later on during our interview. In the meantime, I wanted to ask you, because today is clearly a let's take it slow and let's have a little fun. Why do you think that hip-hop is either hated or beloved? Why? What is it that motivates this polarized relationship people have with hip-hop, both domestically and around the world?
Thank you for that question, and thank you for having me. You know, I think that because hip hop emanates from the streets, you know, there is always going to be a fascination on the one hand, but also a recoiling and a rejection of all things that come from what some people used to call the ghetto, or as some people call the hood, or, you know, that's where hip hop emanates from. Chuck D said that, you know, hip hop is the CNN of the streets. And people don't want to hear necessarily or know about what's going on in the streets, right? What's going on with people, with working people, with underclass people, people who are not in the economy, you know, who are trying to find like ways to express themselves, ways to continue an interest in music in this case and stuff like that. So I think that America and the world, you know, has always had this kind of like, on the one hand, ghettos were created and built in the North, especially right, the urban North, New York, the Bronx, you know, and places like that. But then when the ghetto speaks back, the subaltern speaks, you know, that is not something that people are, you know, ready for necessarily, because many times in some of the lyrics and some of the controversies that have been around hip hop, has been around lyrics But if you ask people who live in those areas, in those neighborhoods, people do sometimes speak that way in the street. You know, it doesn't make it right. And it's something that we have to, I think it became a mirror and a way to measure ourselves and maybe do better. You know, but that's real. That's what's coming out of the urban centers. And that's something that America created and has to deal with, you know, and that's always been, a tension there.
Subaltern, you mentioned the term subaltern, which is this term that I rarely use. I've used once on the show before, and I used recently at a talk I gave at UCSC, that's University of California, Santa Cruz, speaking about how bringing prisoners to the university changes the experience of education for all, rather than having professors go into the prisons, which is the norm of prisoner education these days. And I use that term. Talk to us about that term. What is it, and where does it come from?
Yeah, well, I think that there's a piece called Can the Subaltern Speak? It's a book written by Spivak, Gayatri Spivak. It comes from, you know, sort of, I guess, post-colonialism comes from that discourse. And I'm really, you know, probably stretching their borrowing, you know, from that. But that's something that I do a lot. I look at theories or ideas that I think make sense as a framing and as to help us understand, for example, that phenomenon of bringing prisoners into the university, which is work that I know you have done for many, many years. We're actually trying to replicate some of that at my university at Stony Brook. I think it's relevant. We need a more, I don't know, sophisticated way of looking at hip hop. You know, that's, you know, when I was thinking about that question, there is a thing called hip hop studies now. There is, you can get like master's degree in it. There's, you know, hip hop studies has really grown for better or for worse in the university setting and in the academy. So can the subaltern speak? You know, the people who are at the bottom, the people who have been pushed down the most, there's also a silver lining there. Poverty becomes the mother of invention, hip hop. You know, they connected the speak, you know, the electricity with the, it's all, you know, part of the lore and the legend of hip hop with the electric, you know, with the city lights and stuff like that, borrowing electric. So finding ways to do things. I think it's important because, as I said, and this connects to other parts, I guess, of my interest, in the urban north, these the warehousing of people, both in prisons but also in these housing projects, you know, towers that reach as high as I can see of levels of just people sort of living on top of one another, but living also with dignity. But what do they have to say? And what they have to say, it seems to me, is ends up being what hip-hop is.
So it was Gayatri Spivak who wrote this essay. She's a Columbia University professor. Can the Subaltern Speak? And I didn't realize that that the hip hop artist said that hip hop is the CNN of the streets. Who said that you mentioned?
I believe that Chuck D. That said that. Chuck D, you know, from Public Enemy.
What's contradictory, I think, is that hip-hop is certainly the CNN of the streets, and yet I would venture to say that folks who become famous, and I'm not the specialist you are often not necessarily from the streets. Many of them are middle-class black people, newly middle-class black youth who make it in this world. Am I wrong in suggesting that?
No, Dr. Fernandez, I think you're right. I do, because that's part of the critique and the part that complicates a little bit more. So thank you for that. We have to push back on that in a way, because there is a respectability politics happening. There is middle class values. Ice Cube went to Arizona State. You know, like, we didn't know these things necessarily at the time. Even learning about Notorious B.I.G., you know, his backstory. People come from families. They come from, and they often do. And so it's probably a bit more complicated than that story. But I think that fact alone, what you're identifying correctly, is part of what becomes the most problematic in hip hop. And I'll give you an example. Okay, sticking with Ice Cube, right? Ice Cube was Boys in the Hood. I'm taking it way back now, but gangster rap, you know, was seen as, you know, this hardcore bulletproof image. And then it turns out there's a backstory there. He had gone to college. He had learned, you know, but there's not necessarily, I think that's part of our ignorance in a sense too about hip hop, assumptions made between what the artist raps about or represents or tries to manifest versus the reality. And I think that is important to point out. And what I was trying to get at there is, for example, sexism in hip hop, right? We might have attributed that. We never attributed it to anything, except we know that we were critical of it, rightly so. But isn't that coming from class analysis, coming from the more complicated picture that you're painting of the background in terms of hip hop, could account for some of those things that we have wrongly attributed to the streets. They're really just part of capitalism and part of middle class life and values, so called, in America.
Well, you know, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking that ultimately black people are not very well represented in the middle class, and the middle class black people are a tiny minority of folks who are trying to hang on. But their children probably go to elite schools, and there's a sense that you have to represent, right? You're isolated. You experience racism probably like you've never experience before, because you're in this very elite space, and there's a tendency to want to assert your connection to the hood more than that's actually there. But let me ask you another question: origins of hip hop, and you've got to. I'm looking for the right answer here. Bronx or Brooklyn?
Bronx, of course. I mean, I think that's been pretty, yeah, Bronx, the Bronx, South Bronx more specifically. But, you know, Brooklyn obviously has its own legacy and its own major contributions to make. But, you know, I think Queensbridge tried to make a claim that way in the past, and there was a whole slew of songs that talked about it, and I remember Brooklyn being mentioned as much, but the Bronx, I'm from Boston originally. My dad is from New York, and so I have some connections to New York in a lot of ways, but growing up over there in even more northerly in Boston, the Bronx was the place that was clear. That's where the music was coming from. Could buy it in Long Island when I used to go visit my grandparents, but stuff you couldn't find in Boston. But the Bronx, you know what I mean? Shout out to the Bronx and respect due. I mean, you know, that legacy is huge. And, you know, I think that speaks for itself. I mean, yeah, just respect and respect to Brooklyn, all the boroughs, because each one makes its own significant contribution. And there's, don't forget about that sixth borough of Long Island, also Strong Island, that has a hip hop legacy as well, turns out.
That's the right answer, by the way. I'm from the Bronx. So that's what I wanted to hear. So talk to us about the experience of teaching hip hop in the classroom. You teach at Stony Brook. What is that like?
Well, Stony Brook actually demographically has a great deal of students that come from New York City. I can't remember the exact amount, but it's kind of a demographic twist. You would expect maybe students to be mostly from Long Island, but and so for that reason, because you have new generations constantly coming out of those places, like the Bronx and other parts of New York, there's an interest among students in Long Island, you know, who are either from New York or even those who come from the island itself. I have a comparative I can offer. I taught a class at Brooklyn College for a semester as an adjunct, and we talked a lot about hip hop, as you can imagine, in that class. Whereas in Brooklyn, we could really act it out a little bit more. It was a little more liver. It was a little bit more, alive. At Stony Brook, you know, being in Long Island, it's a little more calm. It's a little bit more laid back. And all of the attendant, you know, things that go along with being a good student and being a good, you know, means for many of these young people, who may have gone to schools in Long Island, means being more passive sometimes, more quiet. So sometimes it's a challenge getting, but I had artists. The class was live. I don't want to, like, downplay it. We had artists in the class who are emerging artists, you know, spoken word or hip-hop, MC, rap. And then we also had Paris Smith from EPMD, which... he comes from Long Island. EPMD is a Long Island-based group. We're going way back to the 80s, but he came to speak to the class, too. So it was pretty amazing. It was pretty amazing and probably downright revolutionary for Long Island.
You're listening to the voice of Dr. Zebulon Maletsky. Dr. Maletsky is an associate professor of Africana Studies and historian of African-American history, civil rights, black power, and urban history. He teaches mixed race and biracial identity and hip-hop studies at Stony Brook. And we're talking about hip-hop for the time being. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. How do you pronounce your first name?
Zebulon. But I like the way you said it. Because I hear my name pronounced all different ways.
you're biracial, and you're from Boston. And we know that Boston is the city that is known for the biggest struggle on the issue of school integration. Can you talk about that? Because clearly that mixed race marriage, I'm assuming, happened in that city.
Yeah, well, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that's a good point. Growing up so-called biracial in Boston in the years that I happened to fall into, which is really kind of like what I call post-busing in Boston, school desegregation having taken place in Boston essentially, you know, in a major way between 1972 and 1974. I was coming along in the 80s in the sort of like aftermath of that. But my parents actually met in California, in Berkeley, in fact. And they're kind of like late 60s out there. Both from the East Coast. My mom's from Boston. My mom is African American, Afro Caribbean. She's West Indian and African, you know, Black American, roots in the South. And then my dad is Jewish, American, Caucasian, from New York City. They met out there in California. Probably a more progressive space than Boston in some ways, and one in which there's many mixed race folk. But my parents, you know, my dad having married a Boston gal, for lack of a better way of putting it, she wanted to be close with her family. So they moved. We migrated back to Boston. And so my dad traded in his Brooklyn Dodgers cap, actually became a Red Sox fan of all things. So my dad had it worse than anybody. But the thing is that Boston is a much different space and one less open to those that fall in betwixt and between, because I think some of us, and mixed race and biracial is not the right terms because that doesn't tell you what it is, but I'm Black and Jewish. Those of us who fall in that between space, especially in a place like Boston, or not dissimilar to the Deep South, you know, Boston in those years of the 1970s, I heard you talking about school desegregation in New York in the earlier comments, but in the 70s in Boston, you know, racial violence was not an unknown thing. Crossing these invisible borders of we call neighborhoods could really mean violence to you and possibly loss of life. And so that's where I say it connects in some ways to the South. But it should also be said that Boston is its own thing of Northern racism. And I make the case in the book that what we call Jim Crow and what we think of as segregation actually emanates from Boston, Massachusetts, by way of a case called Roberts versus City of Boston, 1849. It's cited in Plessy versus Ferguson. But I think that my experience growing up is crucial to my insight about the book. I hasten to add, I had to leave Boston, live some other places, get some comparative perspective on some other cities to really understand what was happening there.
We're listening to the voice of Dr. Zebulon Maletsky. Dr. Maletsky is an associate professor of Africana Studies, and he's a historian of African-American history, civil rights, and Black power. He also teaches urban history. We've been talking about hip-hop, and we're moving on to a conversation about racism in the North. We'll call it Racism North rather than Freedom North. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day, and you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial free speech radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York. We're going to take some calls in a minute, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. Do you have any thoughts about hip-hop? And where do you stand on Bronx or Brooklyn? 212-209-2877. Can you tell us a little bit more about the origins of racism in the United States as you see it from the perspective of the book you've just finished writing, Before Busing, Boston's Long Freedom Movement in the Cradle of Liberty, published by UNC later this year? University of North Carolina Press.
Sorry, I think... Yeah, I guess, you know, my book some sort of will complicate that discussion, but it's really the latest in a series of works that have looked at the North, racism North. I like that, but Boston had not been examined wholesale necessarily. Hadn't it been looked at, for example, in terms of this longer engagement, the busing moment in Boston, because of the violence and because of the controversy, became a spectacle, and one that the media focused in on and didn't, you know, report the big surprise, but didn't report the stories, you know, really situated and didn't understand it. The problem was people saw busing coming really out of the blue. to borrow a term from a colleague, Gene Theo Harris, who's done a lot of work on Boston, it was seen as coming out of the blue. There was no context or historical context for how this came about. And the fact is that there is a decades-long in organizing efforts around jobs, around housing, around opportunities and to live, to make a living, basically, was really the focus of really from 1934 when William Monroe Trotter, who had been, you know, the crusading journalist and editor of The Guardian, passes away. All those years, the 30s, 40s, 50s, people are organizing really around jobs. And the earlier chapters of the book are about that. It's about Eugene Gordon, for example, who was a communist editor and writer. His papers at the Schomburg. It's about the League for the Struggle of Black Workers. It's about. So I devote a lot of time also to one particular chapter to looking at class, looking at the focus on jobs. And as you said, you know, earlier about the black, you know, black middle class and black working class, I'm making the point strenuously that there is a black thing of such a thing called a black working class in Boston. And really, I think the movement in that city was misunderstood. It's a civil rights led movement from the churches, with the music, with the singing, with all the power that made what we recognize as the civil rights movement effective, happened in Boston. But the story really was covered up and other things were focused on to really deny, in my humble opinion, the legacy of a black-led freedom struggle in a city known for racism called Boston, Massachusetts.
We've got some callers, but we're having a bit of a sound problem. But we're going to try to see what this looks like. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Denise. I call on the case very quickly. I find that a lot of the youth are they're not so into colorism or racism. And one of the reasons is for that is because of rap. Rap has really been able to bring the younger generation together in such a way that they look at each other now as human beings. Because prior to rap, black children and black youth were looked at by, let's say, people of different races, particularly white races, as the other. But when rap came out, this is what my nieces were talking about, that when rap came out, it brought everybody together. And kids started to realize we were all struggling. I was really taken by that. I was trying to hit my nieces and nephews to WBAI, and they're like, it's a little too closed out, you know, for them. But the youth, just like when you saw in the demonstrations recently, they are coming together partially because of the culture of rap as well. So it has been very instrumental in bringing the youth together. Thanks.
Dr. Maleski?
Yeah, thank you, caller, for that. I think there's a case to be made for that. You know, rap and hip-hop are much like R&B in an earlier time, or soul music, in a sense. Music that came from black culture, created by black and Latino, we got to also throw in there with hip-hop, that has been a hidden transcript that needs to be brought up more. Certainly some have done it. Without going into that, we have to get into, you know, the contributions, how it works culturally, right? And there's no doubt, you know, for many years, hip-hop was the most popular, the most, you know, it's created a $1 billion industry, and it's mostly listened to, as it was said many times by suburban white kids, were the greatest consumers of hip-hop. Now, there's some things, you know, other sides of that coin. You know, I always say this to my students, you know, when the N-word is used in a song, like, what's going on right there? But I think that true lovers of hip-hop, some of these kids who happen to be white, They show respect and love for the game and for the whole thing and for the culture. And I think people can tell the difference. And so I do think it has brought people together. Remember, it's music that desegregated South in so many ways that and all that stuff. So hip-hop's just another example of that over the years.
Dr. Maletsky?
Hey, yes.
Apologies for that. We're going to have to do this again. You've been listening to the voice of Dr. Zebulon Maletsky. Dr. Maletsky is an associate professor of Africana Studies and historian of African-American history, civil rights, and black power. He also teaches urban history, mixed race and biracial identity, and hip-hop studies at Stony Brook. Can you tell us why this book is important in this period? It seems that it's been written for this moment. Tell us more about its significance for today in the context of Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, perhaps it has. and if it has, if it connects with today, then I'm happy for that. You know, it seems to me that what we've been going through as a country for the last 4 years at least, and arguably longer, really deals with an engagement with racism that is under the surface, that we didn't see clearly enough, that we understudied or we didn't understand, but we feel the effects of it. And so we needed to turn to some different ways, I think, of understanding how white supremacy has worked in this country over history, how possessive investment in whiteness, the whole concept of whiteness has been difficult, to say the least. The fact that in the early part of the 20th century, people that we consider to be white today were not considered white necessarily, or their whiteness was in question. And that includes people like groups like the Irish, Italians to some extent, you know, Eastern European and a lot of other groups, Jews in a way. And so in Boston, because you have so many ethnic, you know, neighborhoods, much like New York, this issue around whiteness, I think, is also central because you have groups who are willing to, you know, do something that many groups in America have done, which is to which is to participate in that longest of American traditions called racism in order to be accepted as American. And we have that going on in Boston in a major way because the Irish, who were looked down upon by the so-called Boston Brahmin, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant who could trace their ancestry to the Mayflower, the proverbial Mayflower thing, looked down upon the Irish in Boston. And that their own oppression, that is the Irish American, comes out as extreme racism against African Americans in Boston. David Roediger. Yes, thank you.
That's going to be the subject of our next conversation. That's where we will start. And thank you so very much for joining us this morning. And we apologize for the tech difficulties, but we'll have you back on hopefully next week.
Not at all. I can't wait at any time, Fernandez. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so very much for your work. Dr. Mielecki is Associate Professor of Africana Studies, and he is the author of a book that's forthcoming, Before Busing, Boston's Long Freedom Movement in the Cradle of Liberty. You've been listening to non-commercial listener-funded community radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York. It's 7:58 and 45 degrees in Central Park this morning, Thursday, March 11th, 2021. We're rebuilding the world together and ushering in a new day. This show is produced by Ajamo Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, Andrea Hidalgo, Marcos Maldonado Cruz, and Craig Bahia. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. We leave you with Chances by Kaitranada and Shay Leah. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. See you tomorrow. Money.